The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Joining me as my special guest on the program today is Martin Armstrong from MartinArmstrongEconomics.com. And Martin, in December of 2010, the U.S. passed the HIRE Act, which increased reporting requirements for U.S. citizens holding assets overseas. It would appear to me, Martin, that step by step, the government is implementing programs of capital controls. Do you see it that way?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're in a situation where the budget deficits are just blowing out, and it's going to get much worse. And so what's happening is that instead of dealing with the issues, the government's going to become much more aggressive to tax people, chase them down, imprison them, I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, this new act that came in December 19th, effectively they're telling any foreign corporation that they must report any activity with an American overseas. And they're going to do to them what they did to UBS. If they don't comply, they'll confiscate all their assets here. So honestly, from an international perspective, the best advice I can tell people is to get out. If you're going to do business in the United States, just do it through an agent, but get your branch offices out of this country. It's going to get far worse.
It would appear this is something that happened in Germany under the Nazis, where they began to collect and find out where the assets were, and eventually, as we know in the case of the Jews, they confiscated them. But it seems like whenever you have a government that is trying to keep tabs of what you're doing, what you own, where it's held, that's a government that has intent of maybe taking some of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the slogans tend to really mask the truth. And that is, they say, oh, the rich don't pay their fair share, et cetera. What this is really about is that only the United States and Japan tax worldwide income. So if your parents were, you know, American and you happen to be born in Kenya or something, and you never come back to this country, you still owe taxes to the United States. So it's not a question of paying your fair share. An American is basically, when he's born, he's an economic slave, and you owe money to this country, whether you're here, whether you receive any of the benefits or not. Whereas Europeans, they pay if you use the services. If you're going to stay in the country, then you pay taxes. A Brit who works in Hong Kong doesn't pay taxes back in Britain. He pays taxes in Hong Kong. Americans have to pay in both places. So it's one of the primary reasons why also, U.S. companies are forced offshore, which the government doesn't like to talk about. But, for example, the Yellow River Dam in China, not one American company got any of the construction. Why? Because a German company is already 33% cheaper bidding on the same project than an American company, because they earn the money outside the country. It's tax-free. Americans don't. So we really cannot compete on a global scale, which is one of the primary reasons why companies leave. And, of course, they don't want to talk about that. That's the reality of what we're facing here.
You know, throughout history, governments rarely reform themselves. In fact, whether you look at the Roman Empire, England under Charles I, France during the French Revolution, it seems like the powers of the state, as the state's debts expand, the powers of the state against the people also grow. Is this likely to happen here? I mean, it seems like little by little that's what's happening. Our rights in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, are being stripped away from us almost on an annual basis.
Well, essentially, the Bill of Rights is gutted already. There's nothing left. It just takes a very simple thing, the right, freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. Okay, I mean, you can look at what they did basically to the Occupy Wall Street people. Regardless if you agree or you disagree with them, I mean, they basically arrest them. They say, oh, well, you're walking on the grass. You're violating. And they say, well, we're not really violating your First Amendment rights. You violated some other minor statute over here. So this is how they get around everything. I just saw on the internet that 40,000 new laws are being proposed for 2012 already. And this is crazy. God did the Ten Commandments. You know, man did about 10 billion laws. So, and we're trying to say the same thing countless times, I mean, over and over and over again. But the Bill of Rights is gone. That's completely finished. And there is no question that somebody can actually protest, need permits, and all this other kind of stuff. So that's all out the window. And you can go pretty much down the line. Fourth Amendment, gone. Fifth Amendment, they basically have held that your right to remain silent, that's only personal. If you work for a company, which basically 99% of the people do, you don't have such a right because corporations don't have rights. So, I mean, you go right down the line. I mean, you look at this new bill that they just put in where the military can operate domestically, deny people counsel, lock them up, citizens now, all right? No right to go to court, no right to lawyers, no right to a trial. They can just hold you indefinitely until you die. And all under the pretense is, oh, it's terrorism. Well, how do you know somebody is a terrorist? You have to have a right to, it's called due process of law. And due process of law actually comes from the Bible. And it comes from Genesis. When God basically says to Cain, you know, where's your brother? He already knows supposedly what happened. But he's giving him the right, he's summoning him, and he's giving him the right to explain what happened, the right to be heard. That is the fundamental principles of due process of law. And this new bill says you do not have that. That we can just lock you up. You have no right to lawyers, no right to a judge, no right to a public trial, no right to even find out what they say against you. Nothing. So we're about as close as you can get to Naziville.
Well, on another issue, too, which is maybe why the government is doing this, we're seeing world economies start to crumble under the burdens of debt, and yet the government response is to expand government. In the U.S., it's gone from 18% of GDP on its way to almost 25%. We've seen increased regulations. You just talked about numerous bills being proposed for this year. And as they increase these regs on the size of government, taxation and regulations are strangling the economy. So instead of lowering taxes and reducing the size of government, they're going in the opposite direction. Government is getting more rapacious in terms of its demands on its citizens.
This is exactly how Rome collapsed. There was a Roman emperor, Maximianus, in 238. He simply declared all the wealth in the Roman Empire to be his. That's it. And so what happens, and what you're seeing and going to see over the next few years, as you attack the rich, as the Romans did, what happens is now somebody now hoards their money. They no longer invest it. They hide it. They don't keep it in banks. And consequently, that reduces the velocity of money. And as it reduces the velocity, that is what creates the economic decline. So that interest rates, even during the Great Depression, fell to 1%. Nobody would borrow because they didn't see an opportunity to make any money. And every possible mistake that every government has made before us, we are following step by step. And, I mean, you take the 2007 crisis. There were over 10 agencies regulating these CDOs. Not a single one was able to do anything. You look at MF Global. It's blown up. They stole basically almost $2 billion from people. The clearing exchange hasn't honored it. Nobody will do anything about it. The SEC, CFTC. We have all these regulators. What have they ever prevented? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And it's just a real giant joke. And the other problem that we are now facing and why government is rising exponentially is that as the baby boomers retire, this is also happening with government employees. So now they have to pay them virtually 100% of what they've been earning the last 3 years. Now they have to go out and hire somebody else to replace them. So the cost of government on the retirees is basically doubling. And there is no way out of this without some sort of honest reform. And government is not about to do it because largely, I think, well, historically, you're asking them they have to give up power, which they're not going to do. And additionally, we don't really have a democracy, per se. You saw politicians stand up and say, oh, you know, Saddam Hussein, he was a dictator, and Gaddafi, you know, they've been in business, you know, they've been in power for 30 years. And then you look at these senators and you say, well, how long have you been down there? About the same amount of time. We don't really have choices. And whoever is sponsored by the party has to basically kowtow to the party. So it's very rare to find an individual like Ron Paul, for example, but the press tries to ignore him desperately. Why? Because he's not really part of the mainstream. So I don't see where we have any hope of doing anything. And because the politicians, we need term limits desperately. Because unfortunately, I mean, even if you want to say a congressman, increase the term to 4 years, fine. But one time, that's it, out and gone. I mean, I don't care who you put in as president. Obama's already spending the last almost half the term that he's in for preparing to get reelected for the second time. So it should be just one time only. That's it for everybody. And then they're actually maybe going to do something that they should be doing without having to say, well, gee, I better not vote on this because I'm going to get elected. Maybe nobody likes that. So without serious political reform, I mean, we're just really screwed, totally.
This brings up the question of what has been referred to as the Fourth Estate, and that would appear, Martin, that we no longer operate in this country with a free press. In fact, I'd call it probably the government media, because its views, its readership is declining because of its bias and slant of how issues are either presented to the public or how issues are ignored. And that's the tragedy here, because our founding fathers always believed in a free press and the freedom of speech, that the media would be a check on government. Instead, they've become an arm of government. Isn't that another problem that we face here?
Yeah, the press is absolutely terrible. I mean, it's been going on for a while. When Michael Milken, back in 87, he was going to go to trial, and then they finally forced him into pleading. And not one American paper told the truth. The only paper that reported the full true story was the London Financial Times. Michael Milken, they first charged his brother, trying to force him to plead guilty. His brother said, don't worry about it, let's go to trial. Then they went after his 90-year-old grandfather and say, if you don't plead guilty, we're going to charge him. And not one of the American papers will ever tell what the truth about anything here. I mean, it's just an absolute joke. We have a conviction rate in this country that is 10% higher than Adolf Hitler. I mean, that's alarming. The only person we haven't beaten is Stalin, and that's only because he basically said, take everybody away. But the most notorious court of Adolf Hitler had a conviction rate of 90%. We're at 99%. I mean, what does that tell you? I mean, the federal government can never be wrong about anybody at any time. So it really gets to be scary.
I want to move on to another issue that's confronting the markets, not only last year, but looks like a carryover in this year. And that has been the sovereign debt crisis. We've seen in Europe the December 9th agreement to cede sovereignty. I guess as you look at this crisis unfold, do you believe that Germany will stick to its hard line, or will the politicians and bureaucrats, in order to preserve the euro, will Germany blink if it means saving the euro in the end?
According to very high sources I have in Germany, if the choice comes between the collapse of the euro or blinking and letting inflation take place, they will take the latter. They have so much invested in this euro. It's pathetic that there, too, they simply will not do the right thing. I mean, as a trader, I warned them back in 97. Look, if you're going to leave every country with its own individual bonds, if you short the bonds, you basically have a virtual currency. It's just a derivative. That's it. The only way to have actually created a single currency was like the United States. You had to create a single national debt. Can you imagine what the national debt of this country would be if all 50 states had the right to issue federal debt? I mean, it would be total chaos. But that's what Europe has got. And largely because the politicians, I mean, the two words that should have been divorced the moment they met was basically political economy, because they don't know what they're doing. Most of them are lawyers, and they have done a fantastic job of always screwing up everything every step of the way. And Europe, unfortunately, is in the same boat, and it's gotten worse now. Where before, if you thought Greece was in bad shape, you sold the currency. It actually devalued the debt. Now what happens is, because the currency is the euro, you have to sell the bonds. So you sell the bonds, and what happens is that the interest rates not go up. What we're really facing this year, and remarkably, doesn't seem to be anybody talking about it yet, but there are 600 billion euros that have to be rolled, and that's just Spain and Italy this year. You're rolling from interest rates of 1.5% to 2% to 7%. So everywhere we look, the national debt of just about everybody around, it's just going to go exponentially higher. So this is why the countries are getting very aggressive with their taxation. I believe that historically you're going to see more and more people hoard money and not really invest. It's just everything they could possibly do wrong, they are doing.
We've seen, Martin, a lot of protest, whether we've seen it here in the States, Greece, the Middle East. And governments, I would think, have to look with trepidation at events in the Middle East where a rebellion used social media to bring the rebellion together and to get organized. There is a recent bill that was introduced into the Senate by Senator Joseph Lieberman and Susan Collins. It's called Protecting Cyberspace. Essentially, they're under the guise of a terrorist attack. It gives them the ability to shut down communications and the internet. Shouldn't that also be a warning in terms of the steps government is taking? It seems like, Martin, they sort of have a sense that this is coming. In other words, people will only sit back and be a slave for so long before the slaves eventually revolt.
Yeah, I mean, they know it. They proposed that within months of watching what happened in the Middle East. And, I mean, I'm a programmer. You cannot attack every server in this country simultaneously. You can maybe attack one server. You can attack the government, but you unplug those. You don't unplug the entire internet. And this is what the president now, that's what they want the power to do, which will basically shut down all the social media. But it will also shut down where the free press is. Everybody turns to the internet for radio, for all these things. This will all be shut off on a blink of an eye if the government just doesn't like it. And they can always now claim it's, oh, it's some terrorist. And I mean, these 19 guys in a camel, I'll tell you, they've taken away all our rights where World War I, II, Korea, Vietnam, none of those standing armies could have done what 19 guys in a camel did.
I want to move on to something that we're seeing play out in the economy, and I'd like to get your explanation for our listeners. On one hand, we have, it looks like, two opposing forces at work. We have deleveraging taking place in the private sector, and we've seen that steadily since the crisis in 2007, and yet we have monetary and fiscal expansion on the side of the government, which is inflationary. So it seems like, Martin, we have a battle between the forces of inflation and deflation occurring simultaneously. And looking at the economic numbers and even the inflation rate, what we've got in its place is stagflation.
Yes, it's hard to get a full bead on the amount of deflation we're going through. I would put it at very bare minimum at $15 trillion, and that is basically the lowering of asset values across the board. So, I mean, if you look at just the real estate market, the outstanding mortgages were about $15 trillion. So if you really just want to look at that, there's a third off of that, you're talking $5 trillion. So the Fed increasing the monetary supply through its elastic facilities, you're talking about a little less than $3 trillion. That's why there was no real inflation. QE 1 and 2 really did not stimulate. They can't pump in enough money, basically, to fix it the way they've done. What they should have done, which would have been much simpler, is forget their friends and relatives in the banking community. They should have basically just taken all the mortgages across the board and just said, okay, fine, we're chopping them by 25% and let the government pay up for that. That would have done a heck of a lot more for the economy because, number one, it would have prevented all these massive foreclosures, which essentially affects everybody because what happens is so much housing comes on the market that your house, even if you're fully paid up, depreciates in value because of the supply that's out there to be sold. And the banks have absolutely done a terrible job at this. They didn't pay attention really what they were doing. They started pooling all these mortgages together. And I can tell you that anybody that has had any kind of a problem with not being able to pay their mortgage or whatever, all they really have to do is say, if somebody tries to foreclose, give me the certified copy of the mortgage. Because once they pulled these things and they sliced them and diced them, nobody knew who actually owned what. So that's why you have some people being able to stay in houses for 3 years and they're getting basically rent-free and whatever, largely because they pulled these things together that never should have been done. And they go to the government with their hat in hand and ask for $700 billion to bail themselves out, not the economy that hasn't done anything for anybody other than make, the bankers rich again. That's about it.
You know, as we look at these opposing forces that we've been talking about here, deflation, inflation, this leads me to gold and how gold has performed. In September, Martin, it looked like as it crossed over 1900, it was on its way to 2000. Instead, it ended the year below 1600. Now, you believe the market has the possibility in the gold market to retest the 1225 to 1325 area going into this year. What would be the catalyst for this move downward, in your opinion?
It's largely this battle between the inflation and deflation. I don't see the inflationary pressure currently. We are still burdened more with a deflationary contraction still, but that probably will start to, I would think, reverse maybe this summer. After the summer, we will start to begin to percolate back up a little bit in the inflationary side. Largely because we have so much debt rolling over that the interest expenditures are going to go up in Europe and elsewhere. And I think that we're going to see that a lot more of capital tends to be hoarded. And if you're going to be looking at hoarding, cash at this point in time, you certainly don't want to do it in the cash in a bank per se. So I do think that people will tend to look a little bit more at the metals, particularly gold, later on in 2012, more in the second half. So I think that, we're going to have to really be concerned about the way the government is moving in every single direction here with taxation, with cutting off the internet, with authorizing domestic activity, with military. I mean, all this is pointing in one direction that they know that they have trouble coming. And historically, even in fashions, whatever appears in Europe, it just takes, 1 or 2 years for it to pop up over here. So the other thing that we really have a problem with, which is similar to the Great Depression, is that what people don't realize is that you really have to pay attention to what was the unemployment at that point in time. Unemployment really was about what it is today. It really only went up to slightly below 10% from the financial market side. What came in as a second punch and drove unemployment to 25% was largely after the lows were in place, going into 1935, etc. The reason for that was the Dust Bowl, and 40% of the civil workforce at the time were farmers. You could not pass a law to make it rain. So it was the final stage of the Industrial Revolution that forced people out of the agricultural sector and into becoming skilled labor. So by the time you get to 1980, the agricultural sector was only 8%. We are in the same similar situation today, except for that 40% figure of the civil workforce is employed by government. And this is a bit worse in the sense that they do not really contribute anything to economic growth. That's why we call them public servants. It's like hiring a maid in your house, and it's very nice, but she's going to cost you money. She's not making it so that you can earn more. And a public servant is basically the same thing. It's a cost of living. Although the government doesn't put it in the CPI indexes, it is part of our cost of living. And 40% of the civil workforce is employed by government. So as government is rising in cost exponentially, this is our great problem, because the state and local governments are going to be forced into more and more layoffs, etc., because they can't print money like the feds can. So you're going to see more bankruptcies, etc. So the unemployment we see going forward is largely becoming from the public sector rather than the private sector. And so unemployment is going to go up rather significantly, and it's part of the process that we have to go through. We have to reduce the size of government, make it more efficient again. I said you had over 10 agencies regulating the CDOs. I mean, and nobody did a job. One would be that actually functioned would be far better than more than 10 that do nothing.
You know, one of the things I've noticed in your writings, Martin, you make a lot of reference to the Roman Empire, and like yourself, I'm a student of Roman history. If you were to recommend something on Rome that our listeners could read that would give them sort of some insights, because we seem to be running parallel to many of the things that caused the eventual decline of the Roman Empire, what book would you read? Would you recommend Gibbons?
Well, Gibbons is probably one of the better ones, but it has maybe a bit of a bias in it as far as religion is concerned. He was fairly oppressed by religions. When he wrote it, you have to keep in mind that this was also coming out of the period of the great religious wars in England between the Catholics and the Protestants. So he tended to look at things a little bit more religiously, giving it much more credence than what it was worth. If you really, I'm trying to finish a book on it to really bring it together from a lot of different sources. There's no one particular source I can tell you. But I think what Gibbons missed on the religious side was that the real conversion to Christianity came only when the economy collapsed, so that people were praying to their various different gods and nothing happened. And that is when they really turned to Christianity. And this is in the 3rd century, so that when you have Constantine basically in battle, he's marching forward under the sign of the cross, etc. So that is really where the major persecutions took place and where the big shift in religious values take place. And that really was driven by the economy more than anything else at that stage. That's where you get the big surge. But prior to that, Christianity was a minor type sect. The persecutions began largely because Nero was the first one to do it, and he wanted to basically blame them instead of himself for setting fire to Rome.
So outside of Gibbons, outside that bias, is there any book that you've read personally that had an impact in your thinking?
Well, I would say Adam Smith, really, his Wealth of Nations, I think really is probably the beginning and the end, really, in economics, that it's fairly simple and straightforward. And that is that everybody operates under their own self-interest. And that not only applies personally to various different individuals, but also to government. So that's why communism failed, because it sounds nice. You create government and you hand them and you take all the toys away from the rich. But, all you did was you took them from one party and put them in the hands of the other one, and then that was power, and they didn't want to give that up. So you can't get away from the self-interest. Doesn't matter who it is. It's our problem with government right now. As we've been talking, it's going to become much more aggressive in taxation because its self-interest is to survive. It will not reform willingly at any point in time. It just has never happened. So when you get to these points in history where the debt is always what destroys every society going back to 6,000 B.C., and there were debt crises that Aristotle wrote about. So this isn't nothing new. It's the same thing all the time. There were real estate speculations in Athens that he talked about how real estate collapsed. I mean, it's hard for me to point you to one particular book. I mean, I've read so many different things. But I would say that the self-interest concept of Adam Smith is by far probably the best overview. And then there are a lot of different books I've read on specific periods. So the one I'm trying to write now is to try and gather all that together and bring it into one place so that you can actually look at Athens, et cetera, in comparison.
Well, when that book is complete, please give me a heads up because I'd love to have you on the program and discuss it. Martin, as we close, give out your website because you publish a lot of good information that you make available to the public free. But also you are going to be cranking up the computer modeling in terms of forecasting, which will be a subscription service. So spend a moment, if you would, as we close, and tell our listeners about that.
Well, we began as a public service providing information, historical comparisons and things of this nature, and detailed as to what is happening politically on a global scale. And just as we were talking about the press, I mean, our readership now is, it's over 500,000, and we provide it all free as a public service. And, I mean, the New York Times, to put it in comparison, has a circulation of 800,000. So we're pretty, you know, large on an international scale at this point. And it is mainly provided to give people the sources where to actually find a lot of these different things and what's actually truly happening. And that you can get at armstrongeconomics.com or martinarmstrong.org. And they're provided, you'll go on there, you can pull down reports written for the last several years. You know, that's all provided for free. So we have a lot of students, you know, that are always using it and things of that nature, and you can translate it into different languages. So it's been very, very good for a lot of people over particularly this chaotic period in time.
Well, keep up the good work, Martin. As always, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you. I want to wish you a healthy and prosperous new year. And once again, if you'd like to follow Martin's work, just go to armstrongeconomics.com. That's armstrongeconomics.com or armstrongeconomics.org. And we've been speaking with the head of Armstrong Economics, Martin Armstrong. Martin, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense. or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.